So good evening, everyone. This is the second installment of our Dharma seminar on a 5th century Chinese Zen poem called Xin Xin Ning. Xin Xin. And Ming is this small one, which you probably can't see so well. But these are the important ones. They mean... Who wasn't here last week? Yeah, several. So, first one means faith or trust, and the second one means both heart and mind. As most of you know, in Chinese, Japanese, Korean cultures, heart and mind are not so split as they tend to be in Western cultures. So the translation I like best is trust in mind, trust in heart mind. It's the name of the poem. It's attributed to Sung San, the third Zen ancestor.
Wow.
And it begins, "The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences." And that is a summation of the message of the whole poem. He keeps saying the same thing over and over again in different ways, which you will see. And it's all about not getting stuck in our habitual ways of thinking about and reacting to whatever we encounter in the world around us. Those neural pathways that become deeper and deeper ruts the more we spin our wheels in them, you know, of our habitual desire and aversion patterns. I like this, I don't like that. But this poem is significant because it's the first, or said to be, the first known Zen or Chan text to be written in Chinese, not brought into China in Sanskrit. And as such, it shows the influence of the native Chinese Taoist tradition that came to be integrated into the Zen tradition that developed in China, Korea, Japan, somewhat differently in Vietnam. Last week we looked at the foundation of this poem in the early Buddhist teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the Three Marks of Existence, suffering, impermanence, and non-self, and also the roots in the Mahayana Buddhist emphasis on emptiness or boundlessness, the infinite interconnectedness of all existence throughout space and time, and how deep insight into that reality yields both wisdom and compassion, which are essential to following the path of the Bodhisattva, which is to awaken for and with all beings. So that's the foundation, the Dharma foundation. So today I want to look at the Taoist roots of this poem, and then we'll read the next section. Is there anybody here who attended last year's Mountains and Waters session? Yeah, a few. That was our theme was the Taoist roots of Zen last year, and we found those roots in the poems of the ancient Chinese Taoist Chan hermits. And since we were in the mountains, right in the midst of the mountains and waters ourselves, it was really lovely to read those old poems. But like many religious traditions, Taoism didn't start as an ism, right? Neither did Buddhism. Buddha didn't set out to found an ism. it arose, Taoism arose as an oral tradition over centuries before the Common Era. Some people, it depends whose criteria, but some trace it back hundreds and hundreds of years before the Common Era. A set of oral teachings that combined contemplative and yogic practices, along with a kind of naturalistic or animistic philosophy.
You're talking about Taoism?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which was expressed in the famous text, the Tao Te Ching, with poetic simplicity and natural imagery. The legend goes that it was first inscribed by the sage Lao Tzu at the request of a border guard when he crossed a mountain pass, leaving society for good at the age of 160. And the border guard begged him to leave behind his teachings, and that's the legend of the Tao Te Ching. It's debatable whether it even was a single person who produced the text. It was probably passed down. But it's one of the most beloved texts in the world, and it's been translated perhaps arguably more than any other. That Lao Tzu's, again, lifespan is speculative, but it was around the 6th century before the Common Era, making him a little bit before Shakyamuni Buddha, and possibly a little bit before Confucius, known in the West as Confucius, the father of the tradition now known as Confucianism. Taoist thought provided a kind of alternative and complement to the rigidity of Confucian orthodoxy, which emphasized social order and conforming to the moral will of heaven. For the most part, though, the two philosophies coexisted harmoniously. Taoism values something we talked about last summer, Zujian, which means naturalness, spontaneity, living in accord with natural systems, not having to exert control over everything, having a flexible and open mind. That's one principle. The other principle that we talked about was wu wei, not doing, or wei wu wei, doing, not doing, which is the expression of Zujian. It's a way of functioning with effortless effort, responding to the ever-changing circumstances of the world around us. Doing, not doing, kind of foreshadows the practice of thinking, not thinking, that we do in our Zazen, that was taught in Soto Zen, brought from China to Japan. I thought I'd just read you. Look at all my markers left over from last summer. I thought I'd read you just a few passages from the Tao Te Ching to give you some of the flavor of this beloved text and see how it seasons faith and mind. The best are like water, bringing help to all without competing. Choosing what others avoid, they thus approach the Tao. Dwelling with earth, thinking with depth, helping with kindness, speaking with honesty, governing with peace, working with skill, and moving with time. And because they don't compete, they aren't maligned. To understand yet not understand is transcendence. Not to understand yet understand is affliction. Did you follow that? To understand yet not understand. So he's talking about knowing in a... He's just talking about knowing that you don't know. There is transcendence. Not to understand yet understand is affliction. He's talking about thinking you know. thinking you understand and not really understanding. And then he goes on, the reason sages aren't afflicted is because they treat affliction as affliction. Hence, they aren't afflicted. So it sounds very much like certain Zen passages we have heard. And it's about that way that when we see our clinging for what it is, right? In that moment it turns and it's we release it. And we don't suffer. True words aren't beautiful. Beautiful words aren't true. The good aren't eloquent. The eloquent aren't good. The wise aren't learned. The learned aren't wise. Sages accumulate nothing, but the more they do for others, the greater their existence. The more they give to others, the greater their abundance. The way of heaven is to help without harming. The way of the sage is to act without struggling. That gives you a little of the flavor of the Tao Te Ching, and I think you'll see how these themes resonate in our text. There are other aspects of Taoist practice. Taoist practice became more formulated, more institutionalized, more religious as time went on. And there was also an emphasis on alchemy and the pursuit of immortality and popular worship of deities that have less to do with Zen. When Buddhism was first introduced into China from northern India, very early in the Common Era, its initial appeal, before there were good translations from Sanskrit into Chinese, its initial appeal was as a source of magic and rituals to influence the weather and health, right? It was something new. It had power. But Chinese civilization was remarkably advanced at that time, way more than European civilization was. So it's no wonder that the Chinese considered their realm to be the center of the universe and that those who lived beyond it were barbarians. Remember later when Bodhidharma, the Indian monk who brought what became Zen practice into China, he was referred to as the red-bearded barbarian, right? In the old koan stories. So to make this new foreign religion acceptable, the early Buddhist teachings coming in, the story of the Buddha's origin was given a little tweak. It was said that Lao Tzu had decided to be reborn in India and teach the barbarians there. So Buddhism became Lao Tzu's teachings coming home. Once good translations of the Buddha sutras began to circulate, the affinity between the Buddha's teachings of impermanence, non-self, and suffering, and Lao Tzu's teachings, the affinity became evident. And there was much crossover between Taoist and Buddhist practitioners. So when we were reading those poems of the old Chinese hermits, many of them were both practitioners of Taoism and Buddhism. A life of simplicity, contemplation, humility, and kindness to others was a common aspiration. to both. Implicit in this was a challenge to the Confucian orthodoxy and political power. In the chaos that ensued in the wake of the fall of the Han Dynasty, which is when Sun Tzu wrote this poem. So the encounter between these two very different cultures, Indian and Chinese, resulted in a kind of vigorous hybrid, we could call Chan. And new texts that express this hybrid, both philosophy and practice, that were very different from the Sanskrit Mahayana texts. I don't know how many of you were around when we studied the Lotus Sutra a couple of years ago. It's very florid. It's just hallucinogenic imagery. It's really long and very elaborate cosmology. And these new Chinese texts were concise, down to earth, pragmatic, with a lot of use of natural imagery from the Chinese landscape, the mountains, and the rivers. Very different. And they place more value on human relationships and social well-being, rather than an ideal of detachment from the world. So this became our Zen heritage. And you can see how it would have appealed to Westerners initially, you know, some of the first Westerners who encountered Zen practice in the turbulent times of the 1960s, the civil rights movement in the States and the Vietnam War. And as far as that goes on to today, as the edifice of consumer capitalism threatens to collapse under the weight of its own greed. So let us take out our text and take a look at the next section. We are in the second column, and the second, and by the way, in the original they aren't divided in any way like this. These are arbitrary, what look like stanzas, but they'll help us keep track of where we are. So to return to the root, could someone read that section for me, please? Evan?
Just that one stanza?
Yeah, please.
To return to the root is to find the essence, but to pursue appearances or enlightenment is to miss the source. To awaken even for a moment is to go beyond appearance and emptiness.
Thank you. To return to the root, or the source, where we directly experience our true nature, our true being. It's so inexpressible as soon as we try and put it into words. We've already distorted it. Either way, if we pursue the appearances of the everyday world, or if we pursue some idea of what enlightenment is, either way we miss the source, is what he's saying. All we can do is awaken even for a moment right here, right now. This past fall, we... For our practice period, we looked at the collection of koans called the Wumen Guan, the Gateless Barrier. And Wumen, who compiled that collection, wrote this verse. One instant is eternity. Eternity is the now. When you see this one instant, you see through the one who sees. So that could almost just as well have been part of this ancient text. And all these later Zen texts were written by people who knew who would have known this one well. Okay, could somebody read the next little section, actually both the next two little short sections? Please.
Changes that seem to occur in the empty world, we make real only because of our ignorance. Do not seek for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions.
So, we humans tend to get kind of upset when things change. Have you ever heard somebody say, I don't like change? Unless it's when it's something we want to change, right? But especially when things change in ways we don't want, or that kind of leave us a little bit off kilter, we don't like change. But we're ignorant, we're always ignorant of the larger picture of continuous change. We're trying to hang on to something, some fixed truth, some way that we want it to be. We cherish our opinions, as he says. Another translation says, don't be seduced by your opinions. They are so seductive, aren't they? Our opinions. We're in love with our opinions and we do not want to give them up. So we remain ignorant of the vast complexity of the whole picture. The larger picture. We never see the whole picture. But we make ourselves miserable with dissatisfaction. The great Taoist sage Chuangzi uses a story to illustrate this. A monkey trainer told his monkeys he would give them 3 acorns in the morning and 4 acorns in the evening. And the monkeys got all upset because it wasn't fair. Why should we get only 3 in the evening? We get 4 in the morning. So the monkey trainer said, okay then, you can have 4 in the morning and 3 at night. And the monkeys were all excited, oh, we're going to get 4 in the morning now. Probably until evening came and they realized they were only going to get 3 in the evening. Now you might think, wait a minute, I'm smarter than those monkeys. But have you ever been single and desperately wishing to be in a relationship?
Yes.
And then some months or years into a relationship, started desperately wishing for what you miss about being single? 3 acorns, 4 acorns. Okay, could someone read the next section, please?
Do not remain in a dualistic state. Avoid such easy habits carefully. If you attach even to a trace of this and that, of right and wrong, the mind essence will be lost in confusion. Although all dualities arise from the one, do not be attached even to ideas of this one.
So he's saying, be mindful. Notice when you're snagged by dualistic thinking. Notice how easily you can be hooked by your reactions and dragged under by intense emotional states, anger, fear, grief, resentment, jealousy. Dogen echoes this when he says, if the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. So Dogen, that was 13th century, hundreds of years later, but he's making direct reference to this early text. Could someone read the next section, please? Yeah.
When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, there is no objection to anything in the world. And when there is no objection to anything, things cease to be in the old way.
Thank you. Now, I realize after I found this online, Richard Clark's translation, I like Richard Clark's best of, in this book, there are 8 different translations, and he chooses Richard Clark's, and I agree with his choice, but what I realize is that what I found online is an earlier version than what's in here. Translators kind of like to keep going over it and just changing it and editing it. So the earliest version was 1971 and the most recent was 2000-something. So I like the more recent version of this, which I'm going to read you. When the mind exists undisturbed in the way, nothing in the world can offend. And when a thing can no longer offend, it ceases to exist in the old way. Almost the same, but a little bit different. Nothing in the world can offend. We are so easily offended. Right? Think for a moment of a few things you typically find offensive, easy to get offended by. Not hard to think of something, is it? Let me give you a personal example of a time I learned about this. I was working as a hospice counselor, and I was attending a meeting with just a few colleagues planning one of our quarterly memorial services when the chaplain, who was a conservative Protestant minister, said something. Probably, I have no memory of what he said, but it was probably, it was kind of snide, and it was kind of poking at my Buddhist practice. And afterwards, the hospice volunteer coordinator, who was my closest colleague, said to me, "I can't believe you didn't react to what he said. He was really disrespectful." And I was a little surprised because it hadn't bothered me. And I said, it was only really after she pointed it out that I realized that I hadn't taken it personally. I just observed him as he was, and made a kind of intuitive assessment on the spot that it wouldn't have been a helpful thing to do, to respond or react. But it wasn't, it was without thought. It was a spontaneous assessment. With an awareness, I think, of his discomfort with what he didn't understand, you know, what he didn't, what was strange to him. I wasn't oblivious, but I also didn't stop to think about it. So I want to be clear that I am no paragon of equanimity and non-reactivity. Like everyone, there are plenty of times when the arrows and darts that come my way produce an ouch. I'm telling the story because it taught me what it feels like to be spacious enough for the darts to pass through without getting snagged. Because I realized, oh, that's what happened. When you are that spacious, when you're just fully present, meeting the moment and responding appropriately, you're not even saying to yourself, "Wow, that was really rude, but I'm not going to react." No, then it's not even that much. But sometimes you do have to make that conscious choice. Okay, I'm going to breathe. I'm going to refrain from firing the dart back. That's our practice, to recognize the ouch, to gently, to feel where the dart hit, you know, to gently remove it, to refrain from launching it back. This is really important because more often than not, what came from that person wasn't as sharp or substantial as the ouch you felt. More often than not, it hit a tender spot that was already there, right? And sometimes the dart wasn't even aimed at you. But you felt the ouch anyway, right? Pema Chodron, the American teacher of Tibetan Buddhism, teaches that allowing our awareness to reach that tender spot, that vulnerable place, in us, beneath our anger, beneath our defensiveness, is the key to transforming relationships with others and with ourselves. And all this doesn't mean that you don't care about cruelty and injustice in the world. It means that you don't take it as a personal offense, even when it really seems like it. And when you're not tied up in knots, you can respond freely and creatively with wisdom and compassion and skillful means, so that your response meets that particular situation. So, could someone read the next section, please? Susan?
When no discriminating attachment arises, the old mind ceases to exist. Let go of things as separate existences, and mind too vanishes. Likewise, when the thinking subject vanishes, so too do the objects created by mind.
So here he's talking about the way our mind automatically creates distinctions between self and other, subject and object, the perceiver and the perceived. This is natural. We couldn't function in everyday life without this capacity. Does anyone remember the book that was really popular maybe 10 years ago called My Stroke of Insight? It was by Jill Bolte Taylor. She is a neuroanatomist who experienced a major stroke and had the training to really observe her own experience during and then in her recovery period. It's a fascinating book if you've never seen it. And she did a really popular TED talk about it as well. But she describes how, as she was struggling just to move herself through the room to the phone to call 911, how she lost the ability to distinguish self from objects in the room. And she would bump into things. She couldn't do that. This persisted for a while, along with feelings of deep peace and boundless unity and oneness. So she was initially a little reluctant to make the effort to begin functioning again, because it was so painfully hard to do so when she was deeply exhausted. But there was also this feeling of bliss and unity that that ultimately changed her life. She knew she couldn't stay there to survive. She had to learn to live again in the relative everyday world. But this spacious sense of ultimate reality did stay with her and change how she lived her life. And in a sense, that's our practice, to function with that simultaneous awareness. And it doesn't mean we're thinking it, it means we're living it. How about the next section? Michael, could you read that?
The arising of other gives rise to self. Giving rise to self generates others. Know these seeming two as facets of the one fundamental reality. In this emptiness, these two are really one, and each contains all phenomena. If not comparing, nor attached to refined and vulgar, you will not fall into judgment and opinion. Mm.
So he's talking about our propensity to compare. You know, we're always ranking ourselves, ratings, right? Ratings. Our whole culture is about ratings. How many friends do you have on Facebook, right? And the Buddha taught that comparing mind is always self-clinging, whether it's better than, or worse than, or even just as good as. I'm just as good as her. Why didn't I get that grant, you know? So, you know, even if our habit pattern is always putting ourselves down, that's vanity too. That's self-clinging too. It's clinging to a narrow view of who we are. It's a deluded view. Just as much as, so the inflated view and the deflated view of ourselves are both deluded. Yeah. Okay, and next section. Yeah.
The great way is embracing and spacious. To live it in it is neither easy nor difficult. Those who rely on limited views are fearful and irresolute. The faster they hurry, the slower they go. To have a narrow mind...
Oh, and let's pause, and then we'll do that last part.
Okay.
Neither easy nor difficult. The great way is embracing and spacious. To live in it is neither easy nor difficult. I immediately thought of this old story about Layman Pan. So in the 8th century, there was a Chinese family, and they were all enlightened. The father, the mother, and the daughter. And they were the Pang family, the famous Layman Pang family. And so one day, Layman Pang was sitting in his thatched cottage, studying the sutras. "Difficult, difficult, difficult," he suddenly exclaimed. "Like trying to store 10 bushels of sesame seed in the top of a tree." And then his wife said, "Easy, easy, easy. It's like touching your feet to the floor when you get out of bed. That's like your practice. Sometimes it seems so, so hard. Sometimes it seems natural, easy." And then their daughter said, "Neither difficult nor easy. It's like the teachings of the ancestors shining on the 100 grass tips, like beads of dew." I love that story. Okay. Paul, why don't you continue that last bit?
To have a narrow mind and to be attached to getting enlightenment is to lose one's center and go astray. When one is free from attachment, all things are as they are, and there is neither coming nor going.
That's good, thanks. And so maybe I'll just close with some lines from the great Japanese Rinzai Zen master Hakuin. So we're now into the 17th century, much closer to now. Still echoing this old poem, he says, "The way is neither two nor three, with form that is no form, going and coming we are never astray. With thought that is no thought, even singing and dancing are the voice of the Dharma." So I'll close for tonight. We'll continue next week, and I'll give you a chance to reflect